If you run a Shopify store, listen up. Shopify's got you covered for selling, but when your shipping volume grows and you're juggling multiple plugins just to get orders out the door, you need tools that can keep up. Stop duct taping your shipping workflow and use the tools that work better together, like Shopify and ShipStation. Think of ShipStation as Shopify's dedicated shipping partner. ShipStation goes beyond just shipping labels to save you time and money by automating the entire order fulfillment process, from syncing your orders all the way through inventory management and returns. Automate the rate browser to select the lowest rates on shipments, with discounts up to 90% off major carriers like USPS, UPS, and FedEx. No wonder businesses that use ShipStation grow 3 times faster on average and ship 15 times more orders. See how ShipStation can help you scale and boost your Shopify sales. Go to ShipStation.com and access all features free for 30 days. No credit card or contract required. Cancel anytime. That's ShipStation.com.
Hello, this is Sam Matterface. Ahead of this week's edition of All Football Commentators at Gigs, I just want to say there's a little bit of naughty language right from the very start.
This is All Football Commentators Are Geeks with Michelle Owen, Alex Crook and Sam Matterface.
Hello and welcome to the latest edition of the All Football Commentators Are Geeks podcast, and we can promise you it will live up to the hype, unlike Line of Duty.
Yeah, it won't be that hard either. I'm Sam Matterface from TalkSport and ITV.
I'm Alex Crook from TalkSport and national newspaper writer.
And I'm Michelle Owen from Sky Sports.
Ah, should we have a round of applause because she's back? Yay!
Whee!
Coming up this week, we're joined by the man who uttered the immortal line, "And Solskjaer has won it," and someone who has been the voice of many heartbreaks for England fans, Clive Tilsley.
He was also for many years the voice of Liverpool and Everton and was working on Merseyside during the Hinsdale Stadium disaster and Hillsborough.
So I knew these people. You know, I lived among them. I love Merseysiders. And I'd been there since 1977. This was 1989. And through one experience that I'd had in 1985, I had condemned somebody. You know, somebody was responsible for it. And I was totally fucking wrong. Totally fucking wrong. And half an hour into that phone in, it became apparent I was totally fucking wrong.
It is an emotional interview at points. Clive has some great stories about commentating with Bill Shankly, his close relationship with Sir Alex Ferguson, and lots more besides. Plus, find out which Premier League manager has started modelling himself on Sam.
And we'll also be finding out why Neil Warnock refused to criticise the referees after Cardiff were relegated, and Crook takes on the 3 games in one day challenge.
And that's all on the podcast that is less subtle than an Alan McGregor kung fu kick. It's All Football Commentators at Gigs.
Some people are on the pitch, they think it's all over.
The only people you know that can legitimately buy a pair of binoculars. This is All Football Commentators Are Geeks.
Hello guys, it is great to be back, finally.
It's great to have you back. How are you feeling? We know you've been under the weather for a while, and how hard has it been for you being sidelined for what is probably the most important and dramatic part of the season?
Yeah, well, just to clarify, I am absolutely fine. I'm literally just sick, and it's horrible. And nothing serious, but it's been so, so weird not going to games. And in the end, I sort of had to say to my bosses at Sky, you know what, I don't think I can do this, because they're assigning me games. And all week I was trying to get myself to the point where I could go. And the last one I did was Villa against Bristol City. I think that was the 13th of April. And my husband had to drive me there. And I was just trying not to be sick all day. And my producer was like, you look really green. And after that, you know, I haven't really got much better. Yeah, and I thought, if I look that bad and I feel that bad, maybe I need a bit of a break. And it's just been so weird watching it unfold, like in bed on the iPad or watching it on telly or following it on my phone. It's just been really surreal because you get so used to being in it and being in the tunnel. You just take it for granted. So I've massively missed it. And unfortunately, I'm not going to make the playoffs, I don't think. But I'll be ready and raring to go at the start of next season. But yeah,
nor's Lee Johnson going to make the playoffs, ironically, your mate.
Oh, no. That was an outside chance anyway.
Anyway, we wish you all the best.
Thank you. We got a different episode today then. This week's interview is a long one. Usually we give around 20 minutes to our guest geek. We've had one or two that have been a little longer, but there was a lot to discuss. And as you'll see from this, honestly, it's a great listen. We could not take anything out.
That's right. We have a special feature-length interview with Clive Tyldesley, the man who certainly for me was the voice of the Champions League and many a World Cup game with England growing up. I'm sure many of our listeners will look forward to that. We should warn you, though, we've alluded to it already, the interview does contain a fair bit of industrial and certainly emotive language as well.
We have also got the usual features, the weekend in numbers, Tales from the Tunnel, but we need to start by giving you the answer to last week's Language of Love. Crook, I believe you have one or two guesses from the guys that have been listening?
I do, yeah. The first one is from Neil Allen. You may remember the chief sports reporter at the Portsmouth News. He's been on the podcast. He said, weren't red and yellow cards inspired by some FA Cup officials sat at traffic lights? And it came during the 1960s. I did say it was in the 60s. I might be wrong. And also Mark Jarvis says, red and yellow cards were brought in for the Mexico World Cup in 1970 to overcome the language barrier after both Charlton brothers were booked in the 66 semi-final and didn't realise.
The question is where did red and yellow cards come from and when were they started to be introduced into sort of mainstream football? And Mark Jarvis is absolutely right. It happened in the 1966 World Cup quarter-final when England met Argentina at Wembley. And apparently, Rudolf Kretlin, who was the referee, booked Bobby and Jack Charlton, as well as sending off an Argentinian player. But the referee had not really been clear about that, and Alf Ramsey didn't understand that they'd been booked and asked FIFA for post-match clarification. So Ken Ashton, who was an English referee at the time, he was on the FIFA referees committee responsible for sort of all the referees at that tournament, was sitting at a traffic light and came up with the scheme and thought, do you know what, that would be fantastic to tell a player that they were nearly going to be sent off and are sent off and I wouldn't need to use language. I'll be able to display it rather easily. So yeah, and it was brought in for the first time at the 1970 FIFA World Cup in Mexico, and since then it's been adopted by almost everyone and other sports as well.
So in a way they were both right, those texts, weren't they?
Pretty much, yeah. Well done to you. If there was a prize, I'd give it to you.
Forgive me if I'm being really, really stupid then, but before yellow and red cards were introduced, what happens if a player did like the worst tackle in the world?
They'd just be told to leave the pitch, yeah.
So they just didn't get presented with a red card. They'd just like, go away.
No, it was still in the rules, or the laws of the game as it was, to be cautioned and or sent off. But the way of communicating it was just verbally.
Right, okay, yeah.
Now we know.
The Geek Sheet. This week in numbers.
Boom. Right, let's get into the week in numbers. Vincent Kompany's potential title-clinching strike against Leicester was his 27th shot from outside the penalty area since playing for Manchester City. It was his very first on target.
Timely. Divock Origi was Liverpool's super sub as they kept their championship hopes alive with victory at Newcastle. The Reds have scored the most goals from the bench this season with 12.
Manchester United's dire 1-1 draw at Huddersfield means they are the only Premier League team to play more than once at the John Smith Stadium and fail to win.
And that point for Huddersfield was only the sixth the league's bottom four have accumulated from a total of 138 against the top six.
Chelsea named a starting 11 without a single English player for the 20th time this season as they beat Watford to seal Champions League football. Only Arsenal twice have done so more in a single campaign.
And Crystal Palace sealed Cardiff's relegation back to the Championship with a 3-2 win in South Wales. Only Manchester City have picked up more away points than the Eagles since the turn of the year.
What a headshot!
It's time for Tales from the Tunnel.
And I was at Cardiff on Saturday night to see that. And really interestingly, Crystal Palace have relegated Hull 3 years ago, Stoke 2 years ago, Huddersfield last year, and now Cardiff City. I mean, you wouldn't want to be coming up against them towards the end of the season, would you?
No, you can bet that Norwich and Sheffield United will be looking at the fixture list in July and praying they're not drawn against Palace on the last day.
It's funny because you might look at Palace and think, OK, we've got a chance there. But no, clearly they are, they're just killers of Premier League teams at the end of the season, aren't they?
And amazing on the road. Like, I mean, they've got a load of technically gifted players and players that can score from ridiculous angles. But they are lightning quick on the counter-attack, and that just, away from home, just plays into Roy Hodgson's hands. I'm going to talk to you about Cardiff in just a second, Michelle, because I want to get your thoughts on Neil Warnock and what's going to happen next. But first of all, Crook, I know that you've got a man crush on Ralf Hasenhüttl. You mentioned it a couple of weeks ago how much you wanted to go for a beer with him. Now, I'm slightly concerned that there's a reason for that, because I think he has a crush on me. I do. I interviewed him for the first time 10 days ago. I interviewed him. It's the first time we'd ever met. And then, what is it? 10 days later, I notice this guy has got the same haircut as me. Now, he had these long locks before, and now he's got the side parting and the quiff. I mean, that cannot be a coincidence, right?
Well, either you're correct and he does have some kind of bizarre crush on you, or he's got a thing for Ben Stiller, because you do look a bit like him, don't you?
Ben Stiller?
Well, no, he doesn't.
He does. Look closer. Get them both up on your screen.
No, that was before the nose job.
Ben Stiller now.
before the medically required nose job.
Oh, yeah, I needed it to breathe. I did speak to Neil Warnock after the game on Saturday. Obviously, he was a bit downbeat. He'd had that great reception from the Cardiff supporters. But one of the other things that we sort of discussed was how, if VAR had been in operation this season rather than coming in next season, would Cardiff be in the league? And he looked at me and he said, look, I've already had a 20 grand fine this week. 10 of that came from TalkSport, pal. There's no way I'm talking to you about this now. I was like, fair enough, Neil. Okay, I'll back off. You've just been relegated. I don't want to cost you any more. Neil Warnock obviously said he's going to have a sort of sensible conversation with the higher-ups at Cardiff about his future. You've dealt with him quite a lot, Michelle. I mean, how did you feel when you found out about relegation? What do you think about what's going to happen to Neil?
Yeah, I thought, to be honest, I just didn't know if they'd have enough to stay up. And I remember, I think, was it in January, they drew with Huddersfield 0-0. And I thought, if you can't beat Huddersfield at home, you know, have you got a chance of staying up? And then they got that result at Brighton. You're thinking, okay, they're still alive, they're still in this. But yeah, they just didn't quite have enough. And if you can't help but think, if, you know, those goals against Chelsea, you know, had been disallowed, and other moments in the season, would they still be there? But most people say, you know, the table doesn't lie. But I think Vincent Tanner said that he wants, you know, wants Neil Warnock to stay this week, despite relegation. And they would be mad to get rid of Neil Warnock. Absolutely mad. Like, the fact he even got them up was incredible. Yeah. I just feel a bit sorry for Neil Warnock, because it looks like he can't cut it in the Premier League. But he's had rotten luck this year. Everything that happened with Emiliano Sala was tragic. Also, the way Cardiff dealt with the way Leicester City came to Cardiff, and the way they dealt with that was amazing. But he just hasn't had the squad depth. And most of those players are Championship players. I think he could bring them back up next season. He'll probably have a bit of money to spend in summer if Vincent Tan gives it to him. But I don't know. I don't know if he'll stay. There were times this season I really thought, if they go down, he'll retire. But he said he wants to work next season. My husband is a Plymouth Argyle fan and has a very, very far-fetched theory that he'll go down to Cornwall for a quiet life and bring Plymouth Argyle back up to League One. But football isn't a quiet life, so I don't see that happening. But
everyone's been sick in your household this weekend, then.
Yeah, it's not been a good time. I don't know. I don't know if he'll stay or not. But I know that his wife loves the area. They're really happy around there. Does he want to go for that, you know, ninth promotion to the Premier League? It's going to be very, very interesting. But yeah, I just don't think Cardiff are quite good enough, unfortunately. Sad to see them go down, but it's so difficult, isn't it? When, you know, look at Wolves, who've done phenomenally well, but with huge financial backing.
Yeah, and that's the key difference, then, isn't it?
You know, yeah, but then Fulham, you know, so Fulham spent over 100 million. And maybe I saw someone talking about whether, if Neil Warnock had that Fulham squad, would he have kept them up? It's quite an interesting conversation.
I think if they had Mitrovic up front, they'd have stood a fantastic chance. You mentioned Emiliano Sala there. I think overall, Cardiff and Neil Warnock have conducted themselves very well in respect to what happened there. But I did hear some comments from Neil in the build-up to the game, and he was saying that, you know, he was convinced if Emiliano Sala had have come in and played, he'd have got those 10 goals that would have kept Cardiff up. And it didn't sit right with me. It felt a little bit unpalatable that you're talking about someone who's lost his life and breaking it down to the triviality of whether he would have scored the goals to keep in the Premier League. I don't know where you guys
I would think,
that.
I know, like, having spent a lot of time with him the last 2-3 seasons, he wouldn't have meant it like that, but he probably was just saying it, you know, when you're
just sounded
question,
a bit crass.
Oh, if we, yeah, no, I agree. When I read it, it made me feel uncomfortable. It didn't feel right. It was almost speaking about a player as if a transfer had fallen through, not that something tragic had happened. So,
yeah, I just, I don't know, you know, we all know what happened there. It almost goes unspoken in a way. You know,
yeah,
pay tribute
to
Emiliano Sala. Exactly. Yeah.
He doesn't need to make an excuse out of it.
No, precisely.
Yeah, but at the same time, you know, he's just being honest. And I think that's one of the things that... And when I mean honest, I don't think he's being disrespectful to Emiliano. I think he was he was affected most by it because he spent so much time with him. So I think it's very difficult for us who haven't been in that situation to sort of try and put ourselves into Neil Warnock's shoes with all the other stuff that he's had to deal with and that tragic incident. You know, he's had... over the course of his life, he's had issues off the field as well in terms of health to family members that I know have caused him grief as well. So, you know, I think he might have been a little bit clumsy, but at the end of the day, I think
perfect
he's...
Perfect word, clumsy. Yeah, he didn't mean it.
Speaking of clumsy, I got myself in trouble with Angus Gunn, or rather his dad, Brian, since we last recorded. I put a tweet out after the Southampton-Bournemouth game in which I said Angus Gunn was at fault for Callum Wilson's goal that put Bournemouth the lead. And actually, I know you disagree with me, Sam. Football is about opinions. I was with David Connolly the other night. He was the co-commentator for TalkSport 2 on that game. And he said he agreed with me. He felt Gunn will be disappointed that he didn't manage to palm away the long-range shot from David Brooks. He pushed it straight into Callum Wilson's path. Anyway,
disappointed is different to a blunder, though, isn't it? And you said blunder.
Yeah, and as I admitted to Brian Gunn during our conversation, which I know you've seen, Sam, maybe that was a bit clumsy. But what was bizarre was that I didn't get a message from Gunn Senior until the Monday night on Twitter. And I don't follow him on Twitter. He doesn't follow me. But he reacted to my tweet and says, if you had a chance to see it again. Then we had a very nice conversation. But it just makes me think, was Brian Gunn scrolling through Twitter for everybody who you know, made a slight against his boy to take issue with that? I don't know.
It must be,
but anyway, we made up and we're mates now. So
you grovelled, you mean?
Well, you said it was a climb down. I suppose it's the closest that Alex Crook ever comes to a climb down.
Is this still on Twitter? I need to read it.
Yeah, I think it will be. Yeah, I think it will be.
Players dads do this. There's a player around here, Callum O'Dowda. His dad tweets one of my colleagues when he writes stuff about him, and questions him on it. So they look out for them.
Ah, see.
To be fair, I get that from Sam's mum. If I say anything negative about him on the podcast, she sends me a angry text message.
she sends you loads of angry negative text messages, but it's got nothing to do with what you say about me. You have, though, managed to complete the three-game challenge, haven't you? Three games, one day. How many different broadcasters?
Different broadcasters, only two, because one of them was for newspapers. So it was Saturday. I did Bournemouth against Tottenham for TalkSport. What a fascinating game that was with the two red cards and Tottenham seemingly playing Champions League football, although not, as it turned out. Then I hot-footed it to Fratton Park for what turned out to be a dead rubber for TalkSport 2, Portsmouth against Accrington. And in between, so literally as soon as I got to Fratton Park, I had to write various reports on Notts County's demise at Swindon because my agency covers Swindon home games and normally just for the Press Association, but we picked up orders from the Sunday Mirror, the Sunday Express, the Sunday Telegraph, the Daily Star. So it was all a bit too much for my relatively rookie reporter there. So I had to help him out and it was challenging. I was writing 2,000 words on a game I hadn't been at while trying to cover two others. But you know, all worked out well in the end.
Is that like correct? Should you be doing that?
To be fair, it was mainly subbing his copy. But, you know, I still had to be abreast of what it meant for Notts County. And obviously, it turned out to be a really good story, not if you're a Notts County fan, but the quiz question that is no more. Who is the oldest club in the Football League? Well, it's no longer Notts County. I think it's Stoke, actually, have now taken that accolade.
Is it?
Oh. Yeah. Another bit of trivia for you. But listen, it was good fun, and that's the life of a freelance. You know, you take the work where you can get it, and you work out a way to fulfil your obligations.
You're listening to the All Football Commentators Are Geeks podcast. Remember, you can follow us on Twitter and Instagram at AFC Geeks. Next up, part one of our special in-depth chat with Clive Tyldesley.
Some people are on the pitch, they think it's all over.
The only people you know that can legitimately buy a pair of binoculars. This is All Football Commentators Are Geeks.
Clive, thank you very much for joining us on the AFC Geeks podcast. We're delighted to have you on. I'm going to start with, can Manchester United score they always score. All commentators have got an iconic line.
That was
certainly
my dad, then.
One of yours.
I'm much younger than I look. That was my father.
The 1999, the treble in the Nou Camp. Where did it come from?
Came specifically from Mark Lawrenson. Back in the day, when ITV had a lot more live rights than we have now, we had both the FA Cup and the Champions League. So I commentated on the FA Cup final on the Saturday prior to Barcelona. And I stayed in a hotel the night before close to Wembley and was listening to, I guess it was Five Live, maybe even Radio 2 back then. And Mark was being asked for his thoughts on the weekend. And he was asked about the FA Cup final. He said, well, the only certainty is that it won't be Manchester United nil. They always score. And at that moment, as Beckham placed the ball on the quadrant for the first of his two fateful corners, I don't know why, but that thought came into my mind. It wasn't factually true. They didn't score in every game that season, but, you know, the nature of the football that they played throughout that Champions League campaign, they certainly always looked like scoring, which they hadn't really done that night. It wasn't a great final, and it wasn't a great final for Manchester United. But funnily enough, after... Famously, Bayern had two wonderful chances in the kind of going into the last 10 minutes. And then Matthäus came off basically to wash his hands, get ready to lift the trophy. And on came Solskjaer, who almost scored with his first touch. Sheringham had been on for a little while. And there was just a little glimmer of hope, just a little suggestion that maybe they had an equaliser still in them, even though they'd, you know, been second best on the night. And in the minutes leading up to the equaliser, he just got a feeling that maybe they could come up with something.
As Sam said there, all commentators have a line for which they are forever remembered. Did you know when you were saying it that 20 years down the line, we would still be asking you about it?
Well, I think... because it is 20 years on, I suppose I have been asked about it a little bit more in the last few weeks, really, particularly with Ollie taking Manchester United back to the Nou Camp. And Solskjaer has won it is I guess the line that is definitive when the second goal went in. And as we all know, that is breaking the cardinal rule of commentary to call the winner before the finishing line. And if Bayern had equalised and taken it to extra time and won on penalties, you know, that line would be remembered for totally different reasons. That I did do the France-England game at the Euros when England led 1-0 going into the last couple of minutes and Zidane spoiled the party. And I did say... going into the last few minutes, if England, I'd said something about what a fantastic victory it would be if England hang on for another 3 minutes, but that wasn't heard when France scored twice, and the Times were running a kind of a celebrity jungle type thing on commentators during that tournament. And I was the second person to be voted out of the whatever 40 people working on the tournament because I called, I supposedly called the England victory before it had happened. So it is a danger, as we know, it is a danger to call what you feel is a winning goal when it might not be. Mm.
1999 was the first Champions League final you did after you'd taken over from Brian Moore.
Second, funny enough. They gave him the 98 final because he retired after the 98 World Cup finals. But because he was preparing for the World Cup finals, because there wasn't an English team in the 98 final, Mijatovic's goal for Real Madrid, I actually did do that one.
In total, that's 21 Champions League finals, is that right?
Whatever it is, yeah.
Which one was your favourite?
I think I'm very aware that because Brian was such a legend and because ITV had recently taken over the Champions League rights. I mean, we had the Champions League from the very beginning, but actually the Champions League in the kind of Blackburn Rovers era didn't have, you know, quite the the veneer and the status that it has developed and certainly had developed by the time United played in a final and England had waited so long to have a European champion, to see the European Cup back in the hands of one of our clubs. So it was a big final. The route to the final had been extraordinary, particularly what happened in Turin. And then, of course, Manchester United won the title and then followed it up with the FA Cup. So we had this remarkable treble. So it was a massive game. And I have really good bosses from the outset at ITV. People showed some faith in me to give me the gig when Mauro retired. But if I hadn't quite been up to it, particularly on that night, I think they'd have gone and found somebody more senior. And I don't know that they'd got rid of me, but I think that they'd have maybe brought me down one and thought, well, if we finish up with another game like that, we want whoever, John Watson or whatever, you know, to come across from the BBC and maybe they tempted Des Lynam across, so why not a commentator? So in that sense, I think those 3 or 4 minutes were probably the most important 3 or 4 minutes of my career.
and as a result of that, there's a lot of Manchester United fans who will have the treble DVD and associate you with that game and with their club.
You being one of them.
Me being one of them, yeah, absolutely. But I remember also, I covered a Portsmouth-Manchester United game at Fratton Park and you were part of the press pack that day. It was the time when Fergie didn't really do post-match interviews and we were all stood outside the gents' toilets at Fratton Park, which is where they used to do the managerial interviews. Yeah. And we were wondering, will he stop and chat to us? He didn't. But he said, "Hello, Clive." There were about 25 journalists there and he blanked everybody else. And I remember you being quite embarrassed at the time about that. But what was your relationship like with Sir Alex?
It was really good. But again, I inherited it from Brian Moore. I mean, Sir Alex Ferguson or anybody really in that position needs to trust the people that he is talking to and working with on the media side. I think probably the biggest single change, maybe the biggest single regret in terms of a development during my career is the gap that's grown between football and its media. And I think both sides of the party are responsible and guilty for that. And sometimes broadcast media try to distance themselves from what was and I guess still is thought of as the print media. But that shouldn't be the case. We are, you know, we do all cover the sport together. And our basic task, and I often, when I'm talking to aspiring young commentators or to broadcast journalists, always try to strip the job down to its bare minimum. Try to take a step back, try to be a consumer and ask yourself what you want from the journalist, the commentator, and then try to provide that for your audience. Identify your audience and serve them. And so I'm not sure we as a football media have done that particularly well, because we should be the link between our national game and all these millions and millions of people who tune in for an England World Cup semi-final, who clearly love and well, more than love this game, have an emotional investment in this game, and somehow that link's broken down. But I digress. I mean, Fergie, I think, understood the power and the value of live television. He had some great friends in the print media and people that he really trusted in the print media. But those half-time interviews that he did for ITV came partly out of a trust of people like Brian Moore, Jeff Farmer, who was our, sadly, as we've lost in the last year, who was our kind of football editor. And he and Fergie used to talk racing a lot. Des came in and Gary Newbon too. And so there was a trust there. You know, at sort of 4 o'clock on the day of a Champions League game, we would all meet in the old grill room at Old Trafford, and Sir Alex would tell us his team and tell us how he was going to try to play this game. And I think he understood that if I, as a commentator, Des as a presenter, Ron didn't come to the meeting, but it was given that I would pass the information on to Ron. If we understood what Manchester United were trying to do in that game, then we might at least be able to relay it to the 10, 12, 15 million people who were watching. And if it didn't happen for some reason, then at least we would have an understanding. So there was I trust there. I think I trust in live. I think anybody who's done any kind of interview knows the dangers of having that interview edited and being, you know, misrepresented and misunderstood, particularly in the Twitter age. Strikes didn't really have to deal with the kind of intrusion that perhaps the modern manager does because of social media. But as with all things in his life, he managed it, and he managed it intelligently, and he managed it progressively. I mean, his brilliance as a manager was that he managed differently during different times of his career, because the relationship between a manager and a player became different, just like parenting, really. I mean, our relationship with our children is different from that our parents had with us. And Stradics was bright enough to see that and understand that and move with that. And I think he did exactly the same with the media. So the relationship that I had with him became better and better the more I was able to gain the trust that I inherited from Brian Moore. I have had the two biggest rollickings of my life from Sir Alex Ferguson, so there was a kind of an initiation just to make sure that I knew who was boss. But they were both misunderstandings. And once the hairdryer had been turned off, I think the relationship grew from there.
So, as Alex said, a lot of people do associate with Manchester United just because of that 1999 final more than anything else. But you started in radio, didn't you? And you had a big spell, a significant spell, on Merseyside as well. In what was quite a fertile patch at the time, I think Richard Keys, Andy Gray obviously was playing at that time. Ray Stubbs, who we had on the podcast a little while ago, was also involved in that area. And you did a famous commentary with Bill Shankly, is that right?
Yeah, my co-commentator for the 1978 European Cup final at Wembley was Bill Shankly. I don't mind declaring, I'm from Bury, I was a Manchester United fan. My dad was a United fan, and he took me to Old Trafford when I was five. And in the season that they spent in what's now the Championship in the second division, I was 19 years of age, I think I missed about five games home and away. So that's how devoted a United fan I was. And it came as a massive surprise to me that sort of 6 months into my radio career, which is what I always wanted to do more than anything, it's more than an affinity, an affiliation, really. I was a kind of loyal fan, like most people are who listen and watch us. Committed to that fact, to that club, whatever, and it just dissolved because I was the same age as the Nottingham Forest players. That I had 18 months in Nottingham before I moved to Merseyside, and the guys became my friends. And back then, the local media travelled with the team. We travelled either on the train or the team bus. I did with Everton and Liverpool for the first 4 or 5 years that I was there. So these guys were the same age as me. They became my friends. And because you're working for local radio, you commentate objectively, but you commentate in the hope that the local team that you're covering will win. So you're a bit of a fan with a microphone. And their success was important to my success. And so I lost this feeling that I had for Manchester United. And so the commentary that, you know, I gave in 99 had nothing whatsoever to do with my United roots. It was just that by then, again, I knew the players and Fergie was being good to me. But the spell that I had on Merseyside, when you talk about timing, I arrived there at the radio station, Radio City, in March 77. Liverpool were on the verge of going for their treble, you know, only a deflected goal in the FA Cup final denied them that same treble. And again, I was just Bill Shankly had his own radio program on Radio City. I loved my golf. I played golf at a golf course where Joe Mercer was a member, and I used to go out and play golf with Joe Mercer. And you're talking about great people. The great's overused, as we all know, by us. But Bill Shankly, great man. Joe Mercer, great man. You know, Sir Alex Ferguson, great man. And these people have taken me into their confidence. And these are the people you learn from. I don't know what I'm not very religious, I'm afraid. The biblical story, is it David at the feet of the elders? I mean, I would drive Bill Shankly just to listen to him. You know, I'd be more than happy to drive him to sports forums and so on just to listen to him.
Was there a famous commentary where he was alongside you and Gary Birtles made either his first appearance or had been brought into the team. At late notice.
He made his debut. It's fascinating, really, because when I moved from Nottingham to Merseyside in the spring of 77, Nottingham Forest had not quite been promoted. They needed a result on the final day. They'd already flown off on a holiday to Spain and didn't really look like they would go up. And I think Wolves beat Bolton Wanderers on the final day to send Forest up. So when I arrived on Merseyside, people sort of said, you know, where are you from? Who do you support? And by then, I was kind of a bit of a Nottingham Forest fan. That's the team that I'd lived with for 18 months, home and away. And these were, you know, Martin O'Neill was probably still is my best mate in football. You know, all these guys, Robbo and Ian Bowyer and Tony Woodcock, I knew really, really well. And so I suppose I announced on Merseyside, well, a bit of a Nottingham Forest fan. Oh, yeah, Cluffy's team. Well, of course, within 18 months, they were the most hated team on Merseyside. I mean, for a Liverpool fan, they would embrace an Everton or a Manchester United fan before they would talk to a Nottingham Forest fan. There was one nightclub bouncer who wouldn't let me into a club in Liverpool because you're that Forest fan. So it was a stupid declaration at the time to say, oh, I'm a bit of a Nottingham Forest fan. But it was a great time to arrive on Merseyside, and Forest won the league in their first season and qualified for the European Cup. And the unlikely draw in the first round was Forest versus Liverpool. And the first leg was played at the City Ground. And Gary Birtles, who'd made his debut on the Saturday against Arsenal, was in the starting 11 and scored the opening goal. And Bill Shankly was my co-commentator in the press box at the City Ground. And you know, for a Merseyside audience, I said, oh, Bill, you know, 3 days ago, we'd never even heard of Gary Birtles. And Bill picked up his microphone and said, you fucking heard of him now, and slammed it down on the desk. we didn't get one call of complaint, of course, to the switchboard that night, because he was speaking for every Liverpool fan. I wasn't. I was still the Forest fan. You know, this guy who used to play squash with Cluffy, that was kind of his only purpose at the club, really, Gary Birtles. Scored the goal. Colin Barrett scored towards the end. And Forrest went back to Anfield a week later and held Liverpool to a 0-0 draw. And famously, Kenny Burns, who was obviously Scottish international playing at the heart of the defence, at the final whistle with deflated Anfield, Kenny Dalglish went over to shake his hand. And Burns said to him, play another half hour if you want, we're okay, we're not going anywhere. Liverpool just didn't look like they had the ball. You know, their possession stat was probably about 78%. But Forrest just defended, you know, two lines of four and kept him out.
On the subject of faux pas on air, I mean, how do you deal with that situation when your co-commentator has said something? I mean, it's gone out live. You
well,
can't take it back.
If I can give you a serious question, a serious answer to a question, which is, I mean, nobody cared but the Bill Swarth that time. But I was sitting next. I was closer to Ron in Monaco when he used the N-word and ended his career in that moment. And I mean, there are no circumstances which excuse it. We'd finished broadcasting, the microphones were down on the desk, and the studio was operating, and we were discussing Chelsea's failure to reach a Champions League final. Ranieri had tinkered on the night, and we were feeling particularly frustrated, and Ron was feeling super frustrated. He'd had a go at Ranieri to me, and he was literally just talking to me. And then he started on Desailly, who he thought had produced a lazy performance. And it was heard at some channel in the Middle East that just took our feed and didn't have a studio, and we just happened still to be on air with those microphones open. So how do you react? I mean, people have often asked me, did you say anything to him at the time? And the honest answer is I didn't. I didn't really hear it. I wasn't aware that he'd used the word. He'd sworn away. He was really angry about Ranieri, and then he kind of went up a level. It was almost like he was looking for a word. And, you know, how do you deal with the fact that you, I was kind of party to it. I mean, I couldn't have stopped him saying it, but I could have pulled him up afterwards. But I don't know, maybe how do you deal with them? You deal with them through experience. You go through those moments in your broadcast career where things happen unexpectedly, and you have to reflect on them. You know, how do we learn from about ourselves? We watch our stuff back, we listen to our stuff back, and that's the only way you can progress as a commentator in radio or television, is to be your own biggest critic, watch your own stuff back. And part of that is asking yourself how you dealt with a particular situation when it arose.
And did you ask yourself the question, should I have done something more? Should I have said something more?
I've asked it a lot since, because I think I've probably become far more aware of the significance of that, of that moment. I mean, I became aware in the following 24 hours because, you know, Ron had to offer his resignation and ITV had to accept it. I mean, I'm quite an active participant in anything and everything that Kick It Out do now. And maybe that's been partly shaped by that experience. You know, I often get people say, oh, it must be really difficult for you, you know, political correctness. I mean, you've got to be PC all the time. I'm a great believer in political correctness. Political correctness is usually correct. It's usually about being sensitive. It's usually about being a little bit more considerate. And we do have a responsibility as live broadcasters to try to use the language properly. You know, I was very close to, I was at Heysel, I was very close to the aftermath of the Hillsborough disaster, and I've never used the word disaster or the word tragedy or the word catastrophe since to describe anything that a footballer does, because they're not. You know, when you've been at a tragedy, at a disaster, when you've reported on them, then you know, Loris Karius letting the ball slip through his hands is maybe a calamity. Mm. You can split hairs, but I think it's a slightly onomatopoeic word. It's a sort of something that befalls a clown, isn't it? A calamity. But tragedy, disaster, and catastrophe are not. They are exactly that. The major events of great sadness and emotion. And similarly, with the way that we use language that relates to to race, to sexual orientation, to gender, to anything that's out there at the moment. I'm kind of fortunate in so much that we have four big 20-year-old things which come and go into this house, our children, and I think they probably keep me and my wife Susan more current than we might be without them. It's an important process to go through in terms of finding your own place, asking yourself. I often say in Kick It Out, seminars and if we're doing mentoring, that I think most racists don't realise they're racist. I think we've all got human prejudices which you have to recognise before you can address them. But maybe 15 years ago when Ron said that, maybe if I'd heard a female footballer on a panel talking about a Champions League final, a men's Champions League final, maybe I'd have thought, what are you doing there? But now, Alex Scott's probably as good a pundit as we've got. Mm. You know, that's how things move forward, by us questioning ourselves, and hopefully our broadcasting gets better, becomes more inclusive, and becomes more in tune with what is hopefully public thinking.
You say about questioning yourself, and I saw that you were very, you publicly chastised yourself really for the fact that when you did the last England game, you didn't realise during the match that the racist abuse that the England players were suffering, and you were quite vocal about that on Twitter, almost apologetic for not picking it up.
Well, there was a lot of criticism of me on Twitter because, I mean, I don't want to get into the detail of what happened that night. There are a lot of working journalists there, and very few people heard anything until perhaps the very end when Danny Rose got involved. And I heard nothing on my headphones. And actually what I was saying was, I wish I had, because I would love to have, if it was going to, I wouldn't prefer it not to have happened, but if it was going to happen, I would been prepared to lead the condemnation of it to whatever sizable 7 million audience that we had that night. I certainly wouldn't have shied away from it. I would have taken the responsibility on and done so, but I didn't have the information to do that. I think, again, just as an illustration of how we can be preconditioned, because, and we're now talking about the mid-80s, because I was in Brussels counting bodies at the 1985 European Cup final, you'll hear my voice change just the very, because I can see them. I can see the piles of bodies, and I know that I went down to find out what was going on, and that's what I saw, and I didn't expect to see that, and I had to come back and then try to broadcast. And my personal view on what happened that night was that it was that those people who died that night were victims essentially of hooliganism, which was rife in English football at the time. And
this is Heysel, isn't it?
Heysel. And so in 1989, still working for the same radio station, there were two semi-finals, obviously, that day. And Everton played in the other one at Villa Park. And I commentated on that game. So before I left Birmingham to drive back up, with the scale of the Hillsborough tragedy now becoming apparent, probably my best friend at the time was my boss at the radio station, a guy called Tony Ingham, and he said, by the way, you're in the morning, I want you in, we've got a phone in at 8 o'clock, so I want you in for 7:30. And I said, no, I'm not doing it, Tony, I've done this before, they've done it again. I had, from what I'd heard on the radio, we'd heard Brian Clough speak, and I just assumed that people had died again as a result of this terrible disease that wasn't just a Merseyside thing by any means. It was every English football club had hooligans, and I just felt that that's what had happened, because that's kind of how it was being reported to us on the radio as I drove back up. And I said, no, I'm not coming in. I said, I'm the wrong person. I said, I wasn't there. I know what happened, but I wasn't there. So you have to get somebody. He said, you're in. And I arrived at our offices in Stanley Street at 7:30 dutifully the Sunday morning. And as I walked through the doors of the radio station, there was a guy there with a ticket. And he says, my ticket, Clive. And he kind of recognised me. And I said, what? He said, they just opened the gates. They just let us in. And honestly, the first half hour of that phone in that morning, we started at 8 o'clock. And the Taylor report was written by 8:30. I mean, either that or everybody had got together in a pub at Highton on that Saturday night and all got the story straight and they're all telling lies, or they were telling the truth, and they were telling the truth. They just, the gates had just been opened and they'd been told to go in, and they just went in and totally, accidentally, tragically crushed lots of people at the front. And and there I was at 5 o'clock on Saturday night, and I'd been working on Merseyside. I knew these people. You know, I lived among them. I loved Merseysiders. And I'd been there since 1977. This was 1989. And through one experience that I'd had in 1985, I had condemned somebody. You know, somebody was responsible for it. And I was totally fucking wrong. Totally fucking wrong. And half an hour into that phone in, it became apparent was totally fucking wrong. And it's taken us, well, we still haven't got it, still haven't got the proper justice, but it's taken us all this time. Honestly, half an hour into that phone in, it was clear what had happened. It was clear. All you then had to do was, you know, piece together the truly tragic story and weed out the people who've been responsible for it. But it's taken us all this time. But there you go, preconceptions.
It's all over, I think. No.
Subscribe via iTunes, Spotify, Google Podcasts, and all major podcast platforms. This is All Football Commentators Are Geeks.
You're listening to All Football Commentators Are Geeks, and this is Sam and Crook chatting with Clive Tyldesley. Really fascinating chat. One of my favourite interviews of the season, for sure. This is part two now, where Clive talks about covering England and perhaps what the future has in store as well.
You have been the voice of England for many years now, haven't you? And you've gone through one hell of a ride. I mean, the golden generation, you had all that. You had Sven-Göran Eriksson. You had the fallow period of Steve McClaren's brief reign, Fabio Capello,
and Gareth Southgate, subsequently Roy Hodgson in between that. It's been up and down quite significantly over the course of that period. Have you enjoyed the ride, or have there been moments where you've been pulling your hair out? Or have you, I mean, you must have enjoyed last summer.
I think that during the course of the last 5 years, that the importance of the England national football team has become more and more apparent to me. I guess that it's partly as a result of the way that my career has gone, where I covered a lot of very big club football. And of course, if you are a Manchester United fan or a Liverpool fan or a Tottenham fan, international football is, it's an interruption to the enjoyment of your season. They're taking your players away, the people that you're paying for, you know, and getting them injured and bringing them back tired. And you can understand why when you go to a major tournament and before an England game, you see this wall of Union Jacks and St George's, more St George's cross flags. The names printed across them are Lowestoft and Taunton and Billericay and Billingham and Bury. You know, that it's not Chelsea or any of the major player football clubs. There is this conflict which actually goes right down to the fans, where I guess there are a lot of supporters of big clubs who find it difficult to really involve themselves with the England national team. But then you meet all these other people through travelling with England, and this is their Champions League. They support Brentford or they support Millwall or whoever, and they go with England, partly because of their pride in the country, but also this is their team. This is their other team. And this has kind of become my team because I have been on this ride with them. And as fate would have it, two of my closest friends in football, Roy Hodgson and Gareth Southgate, have been the managers of that team in recent times. Even Sam Allardyce is a close friend. I only got one game with Sam. I've had fantastic access through them, and I've had an involvement through knowing Ali Southgate and the family, through knowing Sheila Hodgson and the family, as to what this job is and how it affects the man as it is at the moment who's got it, and how important it is. How important it is actually to all you Chelsea and Manchester United and Liverpool fans, because the health of English football at the moment is partly a reflection of the health of the England football team. And it has taken us a long time to get there. Don't let anybody tell you that it was an unhappy camp under Roy Hodgson. It wasn't. Roy Hodgson actually blooded a lot of these guys who are now at the core of the team. And I'm not quite sure what happened at the Euros, because we were doing it, we were fine. And actually, in a weird sort of way, if we'd got in the other half of the draw and avoided Iceland and played a better team, Roy's team was always wanted to be a counter-attacking team, and we never got the chance to counter-attack against anybody because nobody attacked us. So, you know, Gareth inherited in difficult circumstances, but intelligent man. And not intelligent because he wrote a book. He's an intelligent man because he's a bit of a commentator. He was a co-commentator with me for a while, and he's got a little bit of that kind of anal approach to everything, in so much no stone left unturned. Every detail, every other sport examined, anything that he can possibly learn, he would read 100 pages in order to find one paragraph which might just make him a better manager and might just make his team a better team. So he has an instinct for the game, which all the great managers have, but he's actually a bit of an academic when it comes to trying to solve problems in football situations. And in league with the fact that I think he has inherited a very promising generation of younger players, and a little bit of luck last summer, he would be the first to tell you that England were not the fourth best team at the World Cup finals, but we came fourth, and we nearly came first or second. And that lift, that breakthrough, that little twist, that little turn of fortune, which maybe Roy didn't get, maybe some of his predecessors didn't get at the crucial moment, has now created a momentum. And now everybody's an England fan. And it's just wonderful to be around. It really is.
Even you.
Well, yeah, I probably fitted into the big club fan that Clive was talking about until last summer.
Until it started to get good.
And the greatest news about Gareth Southgate is that it's Gareth Southgate. I tell everybody this.
Have you got a waistcoat?
No. And I'm not sure that he'll ever wear a waistcoat again. I think that was then, you know. But that's not a front. That is him. That is exactly who he is. And that isn't it's not wonderful that everybody wants him to be Prime Minister. We can't have him. Sorry. We've got him.
You used the word luck a couple of times there. And football fans are a superstitious bunch, and England followers are no different. And there is this so-called ITV curse that whenever a knockout match is shown live on ITV as opposed to BBC, we tend to lose. Is that such a thing? Has that been mentioned to you?
It's indisputable, I think. Euro 16, I managed to knock England out and then moved on and knock Wales out too. Got rid of them. Just stick them on ITV.
I did see some data analysis of it, actually. It isn't as bad as you might think. But it is still quite bad.
Yeah, if you look at how many games England have won at major tournaments, that there is a correlation there. There are only two broadcasters.
Did you think this was going to be the year, the semi-final, especially when Trippier scores the free kick? Did you think, finally, I'm going to get the chance to commentate on England in the final of a major tournament?
Well, I mean, you'd love to write that list of 10 of the most stupid things you ever hear regularly said about football. And one of them is, England should forget about this tournament and concentrate on trying to win the World Cup in 2159 or so, something stupid. You know, football doesn't work like that. If you qualify for a tournament, you go there with an opportunity to win it. And you've got to take that opportunity if you possibly can. You don't start playing 12-year-olds because you think they might be good in 10 years' time. You play your best players and you organise them in the best possible way and you hope that, yeah, the luck falls your way. And England kind of went to this tournament as the one you can write off. You know, this is the... We've got Euro 2020 actually in our home stadium. You know, we'll concentrate on that. And I don't know whether that played a part in it, but, I mean, at the Euros in 16, England played really well against Russia in their first game and conceded a goal in the last minute. At the World Cup, England played really well in the first game and scored a winning goal in the last minute. And I truly believe that moment you commentated on, Sam, I was at a different game. I wasn't even there. I think that was, I mean, obviously, when you get to the semi-final, the moments that turn it are the moments that you remember. But England got to the semi-final because Harry Kane scored that winning goal in the opening game. I'm convinced of that. Without that, I think we'd have struggled.
That was the best goal I've ever commentated on, not because of what I said, but because of what it meant and how it felt in the stadium and walking away from Volgograd afterwards. And it really felt like it was a seismic moment.
The next game, England was shocking in the first half and they were 5-0 up.
Yeah.
4-5-0 up. I mean, Gareth, I hope this isn't going to be a Daily Mail headline, but he has said to me, I went into the dressing room, I really didn't know what to say because I wasn't at all happy with the way we played. But we're playing against the dog and duck, really, and every shot that we hit went in, and so the third match didn't matter. It was almost, is it a match we really want to win? It's we've never had this luxury before. Exactly, yeah. And on we went from there. Penalty shootout. I mean, ITV nearly knocked him out that night. We did our best. We tried hard, but we somehow scraped through. And then the next game, England actually performed like a tournament team for the first time in 100 years and won a game with no fuss, no bother, nothing anybody remembers about the Sweden game. What happened there, you know? And actually, there were periods of the semi-final when we were the better team. First half, certainly. And weirdly, first half of extra time. Second half of extra time, we were the better team.
Yeah.
I just want to finish with talking about how you've helped other commentators. I know you got a lot of help when you were coming through and you lent heavily on...
Reg Guttridge was my man,
And Motti. You've you've helped me the way you've set
doesn't
me up.
Show.
You set me up with the way.
Don't say it, Alex. No.
No, absolutely not.
I'll try and help you. I can be a curse, not just for England. I can put commentators out of work.
I know recently you've been working with Darren as well at BT and just sort of giving him advice as well. Do you see that as your sort of role as well once you get to the level that you are at?
I care about the job a lot. And I care. Barry Davis once famously said to me, and I think to a lot of other people, one man's commentator is another man's pain in the arse. And that is true. We as commentators, we can't produce more cars than the guy on the next conveyor belt and therefore prove that we're productive. We are a matter of opinion. And so my opinion on what is good commentary is not necessarily going to be shared by anybody. But if anybody wants to listen to it and agrees with it or starts to see some merit in it, then if I can have anything like the impact that the late Reg Guttridge had on my career, just making me think about the job and what it is and who we're serving, what our purpose is, as I said right at the start of this interview, taking a step back and actually asking yourself, what is this all about? What's the story here? What are you trying to... Because we are journalists. We're broadcast journalists. We should be. Mm. You know, we should be somehow conveying... I often say to the students that first journalist was Pheidippides, who was the guy who they sent to the Battle of Marathon, and then he had to run back and tell them in Athens what had happened. That's what we do. We're sent there. We're privileged to sit on the halfway line. And for all the people who can't be there, we tell you basically what's happening and then try to develop and editorialise the story. So that's our job. And that's what Reg gave me. And 95% of what I know about this job I got from the late Reg Guttridge. So if anything I'm passing on really is, it's just coming via me from Reg.
And if you want to discuss that interview or react to any of the interviews that we've had on the podcast over the course of the season, then you can get in touch with us. It's at AFC Geeks on Twitter and Instagram. Michelle, what did you think?
Absolutely fascinating. I remember being in my little lounge. I was 9 years old watching that Champions League final. I remember Clive Tyldesley's commentary so clearly that night, and not being a Manchester United fan or anything, but I want them to win so bad just for English football, and being a 9-year-old that loved football, and his voice sticks in my mind. And then his voice is the one for me that has always been the one bringing heartbreak for England at major tournaments. And that, you know, I associate the World Cup with Clive Tyldesley in England. That's the three things that I would put together. He is iconic, and hearing him talk about his past, which actually I didn't know a lot about, that was really, really interesting. And I still feel like he's like 40-odd, and you forget how long he's been around.
Yeah, I'm with Michelle. It's no secret that I'm a United fan. The Treble DVD is one of my prized possessions, and his commentary is all over it, particularly that European Cup final. But not just the Cup final, actually, because, of course, they came back from 2-0 down in Turin to beat Juventus. He commentated that game. And I mean, he was the voice of that season, and he was the voice of every big United European game for me growing up. And it was great to spend some time in his company. We had a lovely lunch with him and his wife afterwards. And he's got one of those voices that I could listen to for hours and hours. And it was a fascinating chat. And like Michelle, I didn't necessarily realise about his background and the stories he told about covering Liverpool, particularly during Hillsborough and Heysel. It was absolutely fascinating, and we thank him for his time and for being so honest and open as well.
Yeah, he was really honest and open about a range of topics. And I think one of the things I just wanted to mention was how he took me aside in the early part of my ITV commentary career and sort of tried to help me form a way of commentating. He's very big on, as he says, I think, in the interview, he really cares about the job and how it's structured, and how TV commentators, he believes, and he was a radio commentator, need to be a little bit more thoughtful about how they are delivering, what they are delivering, and when they are delivering. I asked him to listen to a game that I did, and he sent me back a massive email of notes, and he's been through a few of them, actually. And he gave me a whole plan of how he thought I should do it. He's very good at sharing his notes, which are also like a work of art, by the way. You know, he's been doing it for a very long time. He's got a huge amount of experience. And as you say, he is associated with so many of the big moments that we've seen over the course of the last 20 or so years. That is probably all we've got time for. I know it's been a very long episode, and thank you very much for sticking with us if you did. If you want to get in touch with us, you can. It's at AFC Gigs on Twitter and Instagram, and hopefully there will be some more episodes over the course of the summer. That certainly is our plan. I think we'll probably be back next week to talk about what happened at Manchester City or Liverpool, whoever's lifted the title, and probably try and wrap up the season as a whole. And then, you know, who knows? We'll just keep going.
Subscribe via iTunes, Spotify, Google Podcasts, and all major podcast platforms. This is All Football Commentators Are Geeks.
Quick, choose a meal deal with McValue. The $5 McChicken meal deal, the $5 McDouble meal deal, or the new $6 Daily Double meal deal. Each with its own small fries, drink, and four-piece McNuggets. It's actually no rush. I'm just excited for McDonald's.
For a limited time only, prices and participation may vary. Not valid for McDelivery.
Coda just made riding the bus easier than ever. Now you can pay your Coda fare by tapping your smartphone, smartwatch, or card, just like you do at the coffee shop or grocery store. Love paying with smart card? Keep doing that. Have a pass? Still works perfectly. Want to tap your phone? Now you can do that too. It's just one more way to move your way with Coda. Get moving now with Tap to Pay. Learn more at coda.com/tap.